Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. We start with good news, and for that we turn to the Democratic race and a new survey from ABC News and the Washington Post. And the survey shows that Hillary Clinton still has a pretty healthy lead nationwide against Bernie Sanders. But then again, you have to stress the fact that it's against Bernie Sanders. So she's ahead. I think the official number is 55-36. She's ahead among women. She's ahead among men, even among the Democrats. But there are some numbers here that are definitely not good for Hillary Clinton. Number one, trustworthiness. The issue that the kid brought up in the town hall the other night in Iowa, 48% think that Sanders is the more honest and trustworthy candidate. Only 36% think Hillary is. That doesn't even get into whether they think she's trustworthy in general. Where do you like the candidates on the issues? Virtually even. Hillary, 47. Sanders, 43. And who would do a better job bringing needed change to Washington? It's only Clinton, 49. Sanders, 42. And this is a Bernie Sanders who is not only an avowed socialist, Jim, he's a guy whose campaign is now frustrated about the fact that Microsoft has been hired to deliver real-time caucus results to party headquarters because they think it's a giant conspiracy, because Microsoft employees have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to Hillary Clinton over the years. So this crazy technology with these big businesses are just going to hijack the caucus. So well done, Hillary Clinton. You're barely beating a crackpot.
Yeah, there are two things that jump out about this. One is, look, it looks like this is going to be a long, tough primary for Hillary Clinton. This is not going to be one fell swoop in these early primaries. And the reason I think like these things kind of snowball for her, to use an appropriate snow metaphor with schools still closed, we saw this in 2008. And you could say, okay, well, Barack Obama is this once in a generation political talent. He just really struck the right note. Caught her by surprise, and this time it's going to be totally different. And here she is up against a guy who, as you point out, is not Barack Obama, who is a self-described socialist, and she's losing. Or she's, you know, looking very tough in Iowa, way, you know, considerably down in New Hampshire, and the polls aren't getting any better for her. And she said, and her team said, we're totally prepared for this. We're not taking this for granted. We're not looking past this. And here we are. And this comment by Bernie Sanders, as nutty as it sounds, what's really, really good is that whether or not Sanders raises this note, presuming he loses or it's a close race or something like that, now every Bernie Sanders supporter has the excuse. Microsoft stole the election. And it's impossible to disprove. It's going to fuel 1,000 conspiracy theories. I mean, in general, this is bad for democracy, bad for America. But to the extent that any Hillary win will always be seen as tainted, I just want to pour gasoline on this fire, Greg. I'm perfectly happy to see Democrats brimming with distrust and suspicion and division for as long as humanly possible.
Jim, any insights or instincts on what the Obama-Sanders meeting might have been about yesterday? Was he there to get kneecapped by Obama or to get a little instruction along the way?
Somebody had put it that Obama's ego and Obama's legacy are at odds. In his legacy, he needs a Democratic president. Hillary probably is the stronger general election candidate, although I think he probably could, you know, it wouldn't be crazy to dispute that. I don't think he looks at Bernie Sanders as exactly the guy he wants, you know, to be handing over the keys to. On the other hand, there's got to be some part of him that doesn't mind seeing Hillary falter. You know, that there's obviously that bad blood from 2008. I think that he clearly saw her and her husband as a milquetoast or you know, a half measure of a presidency. He's obviously not brimming with enthusiasm. But at the same time, you know, Sanders is probably tougher to elect, and the entire Sanders campaign is on, you know, how high unemployment is and how Americans are struggling and how terrible life has been for Americans for these past 7 years.
Here's the last thing on this good martini. This is my favorite part of the Bernie Sanders Microsoft conspiracy theory story. This is actually an MSNBC story. Pete D'Alessandro, who is running the Iowa portion of Sanders' campaign, questioned the motives of the major multinational corporation in an interview with MSNBC. And here's the classic Sanders quote. You'd have to ask yourself why they'd want to give something like that away for free. Isn't that the whole premise of the Sanders campaign?
You ready for me to step out of character here, Greg? If I'm running a caucus or I'm running a primary or something, you know, anything involved in tabulating the votes for a competition, has to be purer than driven snow for our second snow metaphor of the day.
Yes.
You want to have it as open as possible. You want to have there be no questions that the votes were tabulated fairly and accurately. I haven't seen any reason. Microsoft is, you know, somewhere Bill Gates is saying, we'll stop Sanders this way. You know, generally these things are paranoid ramblings, but I would certainly hope that everything about this vote tabulation process is open and people can check it and double check it and make sure that everything's being tabulated correctly. So, considering the mess we saw in Florida and then hanging chads and all that kind of stuff, and you know the fact that in Iowa caucus and Republicans 4 years ago didn't know who won on caucus night, questions in this area are not completely unreasonable. But yes, you'd think that giving away proprietary software is kind of the heart of the Sanders campaign.
Yes. There's nothing wrong with redundancy and having other people go over the results as well, just to make sure everything's right. But very, very interesting quote there. All right, on to the bad martini now. And this has been developing for a while now, but it's kind of come to a head in the past few days. And it's the bizarre swarming to the Donald Trump cause by social conservatives. Donald Trump, over the years, has, of course, bragged about his multiple affairs. Openly talked about his sex life with Howard Stern. He at one time was for partial birth abortion. He's made it pretty clear that he's not going to do anything about same-sex marriage. And he's, of course, made these policy shifts very, very recently. He said that he eats the little cracker when he goes to church. He says that he hasn't really found a need to ask God for forgiveness. Yet somehow, all these social conservatives are flocking to his cause. Most recently, Jerry Falwell Jr., who's now the president of Liberty University. He is getting huge backlash from the alumni on this, by the way. And then also Robert Jeffress. He is a megachurch pastor down in Dallas who endorsed Rick Perry in 2012. In introducing Trump in Iowa a few days ago, he said, "Although as a pastor I cannot officially endorse a candidate, I want you to know I would not be here this morning if I were not absolutely convinced that Donald Trump would make a great president of the United States." And even on the campaign trail, you look at Mike Huckabee, you look at Rick Santorum, they're saving all their ammunition for Ted Cruz because he's the social conservative in the race. And now they're making noise about heading over to the Trump event tonight once their undercard debate is over to hang out with the Donald while the others take the main stage for the Republicans. So, Jim, just unbelievable how when the Trump record is very clear here that so many social conservatives, evangelicals, whatever label you want to use, don't seem to have any problem with them whatsoever.
Yeah, there's two takes you can take on this. One is baffling. I think you laid out a good portion of the objections. I could see somebody who isn't a down-the-line conservative, or maybe one of some of these Reagan Democrat types, who aren't objecting to big government per se. A portion of their objection, to the extent they object to big government, it's that somebody's getting it who shouldn't. Somebody's getting the benefits who shouldn't. It's supposed to be benefiting them, and instead it's going to those other people. Those people have always existed in our politics, and if they're gravitating towards Trump and a more populist-style campaign, I guess that's just kind of the political facts of life. What I really don't quite get, and it kind of leaves me scratching my head, as you said, is these socially conservative, fervently pro-life, evangelical, deep religious individual looking at Donald Trump and saying, yeah, that's my guy. And I think more than anything else, like, you can go into his personal life, you can go into his extremely recent conversions on the issues, you can go to his general crass attitude, his clear lack of familiarity with most basic religion things. I mean, I can think of at least two Corinthian reasons. His cynical answer is that these people just want to be with the winner, and they don't actually care about any of the stuff that they say. And it's interesting, there was a time not that long ago, I want to say 2-3 weeks ago, when Mike Huckabee was saying, everybody who endorsed me in 2008 who's not with me now doesn't care about any of this stuff. They're not supporting me because they think I'd actually solve the problem. They are in this because they like the problems. The problems give them a good way of living. All the laments we make about big government, that big government isn't designed to solve the problem, it's designed to perpetuate the problem so they get funding to keep fighting the problem, applies to these big church groups. So it was a deeply cynical thing for Mike Huckabee to say. It really sounded like sour grapes. But in light of something like this, maybe he's got something of a point to it, or at the very least, there's a great deal more flexibility to the thinking of these religious leaders than we'd ever thought before. Now, look, I can't tell you that these guys are bad Christians or that Christ would disapprove or something like that. You're going to have to draw your own conclusions on that. But it certainly does seem surprising, and as my colleague David French had looked, like, it's not like the other options in this are Madeline Murray O'Hare, the atheist activist, and Satan, you know, and a whole bunch of other ones. Like it's not like Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, or Santorum, or Huckabee, or any of these other guys are like, you know, we do have some fairly religious individuals in here who have a pretty good record on these things. They're being skipped over for Trump, which is kind of baffling. But that's where we are, Greg.
Amazing. I like the comment from Jonathan Falwell, who is Jerry Falwell Jr.'s brother. He took over the church after Jerry Falwell Sr. died. He says he's not endorsing anyone because he's pretty sure that there's people who come to his church who support different candidates. And so there are more important things to do, like preach the gospel and focus on things of an eternal state rather than get involved in the spitting match. Obviously, he says other people have the right to do that if they want to. But from the pastor's perspective, especially, they might be missing the forest for the trees here. Interestingly, though, at the caucus, the way that these Santorum and Huckabee campaigns have gone about this, assuming that their supporters, both of them, don't get to the 15% threshold there, the way that these candidates have run their campaign, they're probably likely to go with Trump or with somebody other than Cruz, because Cruz has been the target of those campaigns.
I think it's safe to say both Huckabee and Santorum have based their political, a huge component of their political careers has been adamant, solid, standing up for the pro-life cause. If you turn around and support the guy who's been a pro-lifer for about 10 minutes, I this breeds cynicism is what I will say, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I think so. Speaking of the event that Huckabee and Santorum may appear at while the main debate is going on for the Republicans tonight in Iowa, Trump is having, of course, his veterans event, says he's going to raise a lot of money for veterans and wounded warriors and so forth. And apparently CNN has somehow already gotten the rights to air this. Trump says this will air on CNN at the same time as the debate. And if the poll on Greta Van Susteren is to be believed, it might get a pretty big audience because most of them said they're not going to watch the debate without Trump. So whatever you think is the reason for what Trump did and the fact that he's not even participating in this debate, the fact that he turned what he's doing into another television event, which might actually get really good ratings, is just amazing on one hand and potentially crazy brilliant at the same time.
Greg, if I turn around and say the RNC is doing a really bad job of this, people are going to say, well, that's just Jim talking. He's with National Review, and National Review said that, you know, the Republican National Committee said National Review could not co-sponsor a debate because they were biased against Trump.
Yes.
That same Republican National Committee is saying, Greg, that they're not taking a side between Fox and Trump. They're not stepping in on stuff. So we're apparently unacceptable. We're worse than John Harwood. We're totally, you know, we would ruin the debate. But this, you know, circus, and I could have used lots of other words in there, this is all hunky-dory. And at one point somebody had said, if I'm chairing the Republican National Committee, look, Trump has a right to say I'm not participating in this. I don't think Megyn Kelly is going to treat me fairly. Now, look, she asked one tough question last time. I mean, Donald, come on. You can handle this. If he decides not to participate, that's fine. Once you start counter-programming the debate, then you're in a different thing. And if I were Brian Priebus, I'd be saying, all right, anybody who broadcasts that is never broadcasting another Republican national debate as long as I'm chairman. This is CNN doing what it can to reduce viewership of a Republican presidential debate in which there's a whole bunch of other candidates on that stage trying to make their case. It's not just like, oh, I'm trying to help myself with the other candidates. Like, he's attempting to stop Republicans from seeing the other candidates from watching. And at this point, like, this is turned into this absolute circus. Ryan, you're the boss here. You're the one who's running this. You're the one who set up this entire system. So nobody's willing to stand up to Trump. Well, except us. nobody's willing to say this is ridiculous. This is not how a Republican presidential nominee is supposed to act. You're free to not participate, but trying to get people to not watch a Republican debate is actively harmful to the Republican Party. You have to be a team player on this. Arguably, it's not the Republican Party anymore. It's the Trump Party. And he has now functionally taken over the party. And look, I understand he doesn't want to watch, you know, hear John Kasich talk about his dad being a postman anymore. I understand he's tired of hearing Chris Christie come in and say, are you tired of hearing these legislators jibber jabber? I'm a man of action. You know, I get that. Trump, you don't have to do this, but don't try to distract other people from watching a Republican debate.
Do you think Reince will open the debate with his really inspiring message again about how he's committed to running a competent primary?
I think that competent primary ended a couple of months ago.
Oh, man. All right. One more note. We noted earlier in the week that it's been 18 years since Bill Clinton's denial of his affair with Monica Lewinsky, which, of course, was untrue. The denial, anyway. Today is also a major anniversary. 30 years since the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up just a little over a minute after takeoff on January 28, 1986. Lost seven astronauts. And for those of us roughly the age of Jim and me, and before 9/11, this was the indelible moment in our lives. I remember I was in Mr. Veal's class. I remember there my old third grade teacher coming through the door to tell us what had happened. And it was just one of those searing moments. Obviously, 9/11 was far more atrocious and left an even greater impression. But Jim, I'm sure you know exactly where you were, and it's also hard to believe for you that it's been 30 years.
I remember a sense of disbelief. Thankfully, it was not the end of the shuttle program. It took a different president many years later to end it. But this was a you know, I think a kind of a national trauma. Thankfully, there were if you weren't watching live, you heard about it not that long afterwards. I think everyone knows where they were. It was kind of a sense of shock, a sense of horror. I believe this was when, was it Christine McAuliffe?
Christine McAuliffe, yeah.
Who was, you know, the first teacher up there. I remember at my school that the teacher saying that, in fact, yes, they had applied for that program. And so it could very easily have been one of our teachers who'd gone up there. I think Reagan's speech on that night was probably one of the best of his presidencies. And I think it kind of, it was a, I don't know about you, Greg. You look back at this, you know, the mess we discussed in the previous martinis. It felt like a better America then, Greg. Absolutely. It felt like there was more national unity, more national understanding, more ability to pull together in a crisis or time of tragedy. I hope we can get back to that. It's interesting that, you know, you look back on a sad and frustrating and heartbreaking moment like that, but you feel almost a certain sense of fondness for how much there was that shared moment and kind of, you know, national determination to overcome it. And, you know, hopefully we can return to that moment. Hope return to that attitude at some time, Greg.
That would be good. Reagan said we mourn seven heroes and we still remember them today. Jim, on that somber note, we'll reconvene tomorrow. Talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.
The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God.